Chapter 55. When I regain consciousness 3 days after I nearly died, my brain feels foggy. Mom's eyes are red from crying. Something isn't right. Her voice was upbeat in the darkness. My first words are, "What's wrong?" "Grand Mary passed away this morning," she says. "I thought she died after a party." "Sweetie, you're confused. And that's okay. The doctor said it's common." Mom kisses my forehead. "Grand Mary died in her sleep." "Can I visit her?" "That's not what I meant." "Funeral?" "We are in Ann Arbor. You're in the intensive care unit at the U of M Medical Center. Aunt Teddy was here, but she went back home to make the arrangements." "But Grand Mary doesn't like any firekeepers," I say. "Teddy offered so I could stay here. I'm not leaving you."
"Are you sure Grand Mary didn't die after my graduation party?"
"She was in between, I think," Mom says. "Maybe she waited until we weren't there so she could leave us. It's a comforting thought, don't you think?"
"No, it's weird. I'm weird. My brain is fuzzy. I'm sorry, Mom. I'm going back to sleep."
Mom kisses me again. There's healing medicine in those kisses. 1 week ago, I, Donis Lorenza Fontaine, deliberately grabbed the steering wheel of a BMW to veer off the road to get the attention of a tribal police officer so I could sprint back to the ferry launch, where I borrowed Minnie Manitou's tomato red Mustang to lead a high-speed caravan of law enforcement vehicles to an old aluminum trailer to rescue someone whose name I don't know, so his life could not be used as a threat to pressure me into cooking high-quality crystal methamphetamine for a drug operation whose product was distributed via souvenir pucks at hockey games, primarily in the Great Lakes states and Ontario. I take a huge breath and keep going. However, when the car hit a tree or two, my liver was torn, probably a grade 1 or 2 laceration originally, but exacerbated to a grade 4 when I jumped on someone who was helping, but I didn't know that at the time, and I bled internally, undetected, until my blood volume level decreased and I went into hypovolemic shock, which would have killed me if not for the quick actions of my Aunt Teddy, who is a registered nurse, and the Coast Guard boat that transported me to the local hospital so I could be stabilized and taken by medical helicopter to the University of Michigan Medical Center in Ann Arbor, where I was unconscious for 3 days and then monitored for 3 more days in the intensive care unit as a precaution against rebleeding and other liver complications. But I am now in a regular room, currently answering your question, which is whether I am aware of my surroundings and the events that led me here. Dr. Roulain blinks in surprise, then smiles. "Well, Donis, I'll note in the chart your mental capacity is undiminished. We want to keep you here through next week and monitor you as you increase physical activity. As you stated, we are watching for rebleeding and other complications, such as slow-developing biliary tract lesions or infection from sepsis or hepatic abscess. After that, we will transfer your outpatient care to the hepatology clinic." Mom asks about the time frame for my liver to heal fully. "The liver is the only internal organ that can regenerate," Dr. Roulain explains. "Even if your daughter's liver had torn completely, it would grow back to its full mass within 6 months. Since her injury was a laceration, or tear, it should take a few months for her liver to heal." He turns to me. "Now, I hear you're a hockey player. You need to avoid all contact sports, including hockey, for at least 6 months. To be on the safe side, I'd recommend a year-long hiatus." I squeeze Mom's hand before answering. "I gave up hockey because of nerve damage from chronic shoulder instability," I say. After Dr. Roulain leaves, I pause before I speak. I already alerted my mother that she was going to hear a lot of secrets that might surprise or hurt her.
"Protecting my feelings is something you can let go of, Donis," she said.
Once I stop analyzing and filtering my words, I find I have more energy. It turns out that lies, in whatever form, are exhausting.
I start with the most important secret first. Uncle David was helping the FBI as a confidential informant. Mom's hands fly to her mouth, trapping any gasp or sob. I continue in her silence. He was researching mushrooms on Sugar Island that might have been added to crystal meth to cause hallucinations. I add, he was concerned about Levi and went to talk to Dana about him. That's when Uncle David went missing. I don't know what happened after that. When my mother moves her hands from her face, her eyes shine with vindication that she had been right about her brother, Uncle David's only defender. The FBI might know more by now. Dana could have confessed, I say. I don't know what details will come out. David would only care that you and I know it was foul play. And his students, I think. Mom seems at peace. He lived his life not caring what the gossips thought. Auntie brings bundles of medicine when she arrives 2 days later. She cannot strike a fire to smudge the room, but we know it's there. She has the sage, cedar, sweetgrass, and tobacco nestled in the iridescent bowl of an abalone shell on my bedside table, next to the raspberry lipstick that gives my mother an inordinate amount of pleasure to put on me every morning. My aunt has been the dearest friend to my mother for my entire life. She ensured that Mom's wishes were followed. Grand Mary wanted to be cremated and her ashes placed with Grandpa Lorenzo after a memorial service that would be scheduled once I was back home. From a place of love and with a good heart, Auntie tended to my grandmother's final journey. I loved Grand Mary, and I know she loved me. Correction, I love her, and she loves me. When our loved ones die, the love stays alive in the present. Ron is my first non-family visitor now that I've been moved from the intensive care unit to a private room on the regular inpatient floor. My mother bought a white cotton nightgown and a matching robe for me. Although it's more her style than mine, I'm thankful to be wearing something other than the standard issue hospital gown. I sit in a chair flanked by Mom and Auntie. It feels good not to be alone. Ron pulls up a chair across from me. Donis, let me begin by thanking you for helping with the investigation, he says. Mom interrupts. You put my daughter in an impossible situation. She squeezes my hand. It may have been legal, but it was hardly ethical. Ron accepts her anger, saying nothing to defend himself. Who are you? Auntie asks. My name is Ron Cornell, senior field agent with the FBI. Not what you do, she clarifies. Who are your people? Which community claims you? Her voice is neither friendly nor hostile. It's her speaking to tribal council voice. He names a tribe from out west, grew up in Denver. Does your family know what you do, going undercover in tribal communities? They know I work for the FBI, Ron tells her. My sister thinks it's dangerous. My cousins think I'm a sellout. I do this work because we need good people working at the agencies that help tribes. Auntie snorts. Scariest words ever spoken. I'm from the federal government and I'm here to help. She continues. Was anyone from our tribal law enforcement involved? This is a federal investigation. We kept the tribe out of it because there have been investigations on other reservations where people in law enforcement have tipped off family members. He pauses to clear his throat. I can't speak to more details because the U.S. Attorney's Office is still pursuing charges. What can you speak to? She asks. Ron focuses his attention on me. Levi has been charged with several crimes. Kidnapping of a federal officer, possession, manufacture, or distribution of controlled substances, maintaining a drug-involved premises, employment or use of persons under 18 years of age in drug operations, and conspiracy to defraud the United States. The financial crimes fall under Canadian jurisdiction. You've been implicated in the wire transfers, so you'll need to get an attorney. But it should be fairly straightforward because the evidence will show Levi's activity. He pauses. When we searched his bedroom, a woman's black platform flip-flop was found in one of the boxes in his closet.
It's the same style Heather was seen wearing on Labor Day, and it's her shoe size. Levi is being questioned about her disappearance.
Ron, I searched every box and bin in that closet looking for my dad's scarf. If the sandal was there before that Sunday, I would have found it. Someone put it there afterward.
I meet Auntie's gaze. Levi is guilty of many things. He may or may not be involved with Heather Noden's death, but the timing of when the evidence turned up feels, I use Ron's word, kinky.
I agree, Ron says.
I think Mike put Heather's flip-flop in Levi's closet. He's been the mastermind this entire time. Mike had access to Levi's room and could have set up my brother to take the fall.
I can see Ron mulling this over, and I lean forward.
When you question Levi, watch his face when you tell him about Heather's flip-flop. That's when he will realize he was set up. Levi might turn on Mike at that point.
I sigh. Maybe he won't, though. Levi's choices have been disappointing. It takes a few beats for Ron to respond. Michael Edwards is missing. No one saw him leave Sugar Island. Our best guess is that he crossed into Canada and accessed money and resources there. We've questioned his parents. They were shocked to learn about their son's involvement. Devastated, really.
Grant Edwards wasn't the person Levi called from the ferry, but he still might be involved, I tell Ron. He nods to acknowledge my suspicion, but doesn't confirm or deny.
I envision Mike finding the narrowest passage on the North Channel, swimming the frigid water and struggling not to get pulled under its treacherous current, regrouping on the other side, doing post-game analysis and plotting his next move, basing his strategy on quotes from his dad, Coach Bobby, and Sun Tzu. Starting over somewhere, it seems more likely that Mike would have help from his dad.
What about Stormy? I still don't know why he freed Jamie, I say.
Auntie pats my hand.
Stormy Noden hasn't spoken a single word since I led him from that trailer, Ron says. Since he's a minor for a few more months, his parents have to be with him when he's questioned.
Ron looks perplexed.
He hasn't even talked to the attorney his parents hired.
Maybe Stormy would rather stay quiet than do or say anything to hurt Levi, I say.
What happens if he never talks?
Well, there's little, if anything, that can be done while he's a juvenile, Ron says. The statute of limitations on federal cases is 5 years. So, once Stormy turns 18, the U.S. Attorney's Office can subpoena him into a grand jury. He could be charged with obstruction of justice for failing to provide relevant evidence and even possibly charged for aiding and abetting if any facts suggest he may have been involved.
What if he heard or witnessed stuff but told Levi he wouldn't be part of it? I ask.
If Stormy wasn't involved, he could still be called to the grand jury and put under oath. Should he refuse to testify, the U.S. Attorney's Office would request a hearing in front of a federal judge to order him to testify.
Ron pauses. If Stormy Noden never talks, he could be held in contempt and kept in jail until he complies. I say aloud what I know in my heart with a sinking, nauseating certainty. Levi and Stormy are going to sit in jail while Mike gets away with everything. I take Ron's silence as agreement. Auntie reaches for a tissue to wipe her eyes. Mom hugs me, the only comfort she can provide. After a few minutes, Ron begins speaking again.
I'm sorry, Donis. I know this is a lot to take in, but I wanted to make sure you heard everything from me. Robert LaFleur was charged with several counts of being part of a conspiracy to distribute methamphetamines on the reservation, aiding and abetting. He had an accomplice at the casino who wasn't filing currency reports for cash deposits of more than $10,000. That's how he was able to launder money.
I had ignored the clues. The fancy car, the high-end renovation to his waterfront cabin, gambling trips to Vegas, a lifestyle that exceeded a teacher's salary and modest rental income. I don't understand how Coach could treat me so well for all those years and then, over and over, I relive the moment when Coach moved his cell phone away from me and the realization hit me like a slap shot to the throat. Coach is involved.
The man who Mom had trusted with my health and safety was willing to drive me to an isolated house or garage to cook meth for the business he had with Mike and Levi. My brother was on board with the plan. Levi's betrayal is a sinking anchor that still hasn't found bottom. I look at Ron, who is waiting patiently for my attention to return. He continues after I nod. Dana Firekeeper has been charged with several counts of aiding and abetting a conspiracy to distribute methamphetamines on the reservation. Those are only the federal charges. The tribe is expected to file charges against her after finishing an audit of her tribal court cases. Ron sounds genuinely shocked. It looks like, as tough as Judge Firekeeper was on alcohol-related crimes and some drug crimes, a number of meth-related cases were dismissed on technicalities in her court. She protected Levi's operations while taking actions against his competition. What about her drugging and kidnapping me? My voice shakes with fury. Auntie, wouldn't my blood still have had traces of Rohypnol when I was in the ER in the Sioux? Before my aunt can answer, Ron clears his throat. Donis, there's something else I need to talk about with you. Ron braces himself, breathing deeply and exhaling loudly. A chill runs down my spine. The trailer is on land the tribe purchased a few years back and put into federal trust. I wait for Ron to continue, but he seems unable to go on. Auntie gasps. I feel her sharp intake within my own lungs. She tells me what Ron cannot. You were an enrolled citizen when Dana took you. When a crime takes place on Indian land and the victim is a tribal member, the feds decide whether to press charges. Her words fit between sobs. They're not going to pursue charges for your kidnapping. Only Jamie's. Special Agent Ron Cornell doesn't meet my eyes. Did Jamie tell you that Grant Edwards raped me in a hotel room at Shagala? I shout, feeling my mother stiffen next to me. When Jamie put his GPS watch around my ankle, he said to tell you what Grant did so the U.S. Attorney's Office could seek justice for me. I shake my head. Jamie's naive, isn't he? He thought, after all I did for the FBI, that my case would get more consideration from a federal prosecutor than what's normally given to Native women. I stare at Ron until he meets my eyes. Jamie doesn't know that 10 times 0 is still 0, I say flatly. Then something else occurs to me. I think Grant Edwards planned to rape me as soon as he heard about my enrollment vote. He knew the resort was on tribal land. He counted on the federal government not wasting resources going after non-native guys like him. They knew the tribal court couldn't touch him. I am so tired. The weight of my expendability is crushing. Not everyone gets justice, least of all Nishkwawog. Ron seems at a loss for what might be appropriate closure under the circumstances, so I do it for him. Please go, Ron. I hold my stare until he breaks away. As he leaves the room, I collapse against Auntie and my mother. I picture Grant Edwards rolled up in a blanket in the trunk of a car deep in the woods on Sugar Island. My female cousins lift the heavy roll and drop it on the ground. The muffled groan is an echo of the one in my ear on a hotel bed where the sheets smelled of lavender. Blanket party, I tell Auntie. You'll bring me. She exhales and closes her eyes. When she opens them and nods, Auntie has aged 10 years in one blink.